Hello, and welcome to the FactSet Insight podcast. Today, we're going to discuss the fixed income Q4 market outlook and tie that into some of how this can be used in FactSet's products. Today, I'm joined by Pat Riley, Director of our Institutional Buy Side here at Americas. My name is Matt Barnes. I'm a middle office product specialist. Let's dive in. So Pat, I want to start by looking at the state of the fixed income market compared to the end of 24.
Yeah, Matt, great question. And there's so much to unpack, right? If you look at where we're at here, early November 2025, recall it was just only over a year ago that the yield curve was still inverted, right? Recession was definitely a certainty. Inflation had not been defeated yet, et cetera. It's a very different world in terms of monetary policy, not to mention fiscal policy. There's other trends, though, that we're also seeing. Right. So, you know, things that are a little bit ongoing, but maybe a bit more of a question mark today than a year ago. What about the growth and sustainability of private credit as an asset class? A year ago, that was a near certainty. Today, we're hearing about potential fraud. We're hearing about frothiness in the market. So is that sustainable? And how does that impact broader credit markets, both public and private? You continue to see really tight valuations. Credit spreads are tight across the corporate space, but even more so seen in lower quality credits. So, you know, that high yield, think double B, single B, trading tighter than ever before. You do see that in higher quality names too. Obviously the Fed is still in focus. You know, it was the end of last summer that I was thinking about and talking about why the Fed should not cut rates. We're looking at a potential new chairman in 2026. We're looking at potentially carrying on this easing cycle. And there's a huge question mark around the duration of this easing cycle and the magnitude. How low is low enough? What is a neutral rate of interest, et cetera? You're looking at the end of quantitative tightening, right? The Fed recently announced they're going to stop reducing their balance sheet or rolling off their balance sheet. You still have a continued inflation story, whether you're looking at CPI, or another measure, right? So there's definitely a lot going on macro. And then we're also starting to see new vehicles come to market from our clients. And so thinking about different ways to gather assets, whether those are public-private interval funds, things like tax-advantaged opportunity zones, defined outcome products, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ways you could get yield outside of plain vanilla fixed income. But where I would leave it from an intro perspective is fixed income continues to be really, really dynamic. There's still a lot of uncertainty in the future, but you see that dynamism in specifically in the interest rate environment relative to 2024.
Great. Thanks, Pat. Moving on, the yield curve, as we move from a inverted, deeply flat curve to a flatter, modestly positively sloped curve, can you talk a little bit about the steepener trade? Is that still a play?
Definitely. You know, my opinion only, this is not financial advice, but I do think the steepener still has room to run. Taking a step back and introducing the concept a little bit more compactly, the steepener trade has been really popular for at least the past year once the curve reverted. And this is where you see investors go longer, shorter duration, or the low end or front end of the curve, and short or underweight longer duration paper, right? And so the idea here is there's a bit of a logical trade to it, given that shorter rates anchor to Fed policy. I think one of the common mistakes or misnomers about the yield curve in general is that the Fed sets all rates, when in reality, the Fed controls the Fed funds rate, which influences short-term rates. You'll hear about the two-year being really susceptible or really sensitive to Fed funds policy. At the longer end of the curve, so think corporate credit, think mortgages, et cetera, that really does tend to be market-driven. So Fed policy and monetary policy is really only going to impact one aspect of yield curve positioning today. Why do I think this still has room to run? Well, partially, it depends a little bit on how you measure the steepness or the slope of the curve. And you could use a variety of measures. I'll read firms that are looking at the slope between the two-year and the 30-year. I'll see the five and the 30-year. I prefer to use the 210 or the 210 spread. You know, since the curve reverted, the spread has typically been about 50 to 60 basis points. And what kind of stuck with me as I've been thinking about this over the past few months is I hadn't been reading any analysis about where that slope could go and how did it look historically. And so that's what I started to unpack. And again, I did this over those different tenors, the 230, 530, 210, spent most of my time on the 210 spread. And what I was able to observe, and I think there's another important call out here too. We're roughly 15 years out from the financial crisis. So there's an entire generation of investors that thinks a zero interest rate policy or a zero bound rate policy is normal. You know, that steepener component, though, you need to look at over a longer time frame, and you need to look at over multiple time horizons. And what I found was that really since the financial crisis, so over the past roughly 15 years, that 210 spread has actually averaged about 100 basis points. You know, you're thinking about a range like 95 to 110 for the most part. That's in the entire 15-year time frame. What we actually see, though, is that spread tends to peak at roughly 250 basis points during dovish regimes. So when money is easy, that 210 spread is actually the widest. And so when you look at the relation today, where we're looking at a spread of just over 50 basis points, there's at a minimum roughly 50 basis points of movement that we should expect, but potentially another 200 basis points of movement that we could expect. And that could be a combination of the short end dropping, the long end rising across a variety of outcomes, right? And so I think it's really important to understand the history, and then also really reflect on the idea that the yield curve was actually inverted for nearly 2 years. So that to me, I think is incredibly important as a takeaway and why the trade still has legs. I think there's a variety of outcomes that are potential there. But again, you do see potential risk trade-offs there.
Great. Thanks, Pat. And I guess looking forward, why would we continue to see the widening, steepening, or what would be the largest contributor to that, given where spreads are at today?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's three examples or three reasons why I think you would continue to see the steepening or this widening in that spread. One, it is just the impact of normal Fed action. So if we're thinking about another potential December interest rate cut, potential forecast is for another two in the very beginning stages of the year. Right off the bat, you're looking at potentially 75 basis points movement, assuming over that 6 to 9 month horizon, the forward rate comes down and there's no change in the long end, right? I think it's important to talk about the concept of financial repression, just given the potential politicization of the Fed over the next few years. So if you're pushing rates at the low end down, what does that do from a risk appetite for longer dated paper? So that could actually, in my opinion, push the long end up. At the same time, you're dropping the low end with monetary policy or the front end due to monetary policy. So that's kind of a hybrid move. And then I think there's also greater just market demand of compensation via yield going further out the curve. Some of that is related to inflation. Some of that's related to tariff uncertainty. Some of that is related to overall fiscal policy and government debt load. So there's not one thing, but I would say across kind of those three aspects, those are what stand out to me in terms of why this trade continues. So Matt, switching gears a little bit, you know, we've gotten into the steepener, we've gotten into yield curve positioning. How are you seeing FactSet's clients actually implement this kind of testing, whether it's alpha seeking or risk management? You know, what are you seeing clients do across their portfolio analysis approach to that?
Yeah, thanks, Pat. I think what we're seeing today is our clients are actively using FactSet's tools that we offer to do real-time stress testing and decomposition of their portfolios, whether it's all long fixed income, multi-asset class, fund to funds, bottoms up, top down. Given the upcoming potential rate cuts, we're seeing a lot of clients that are, of course, running parallel shifts and seeing the impact on their market values, durations, expected total return. We have insurers seeing the impact on book values and book yields. But since the tools are so dynamic, what they're actually able to do is to really get granular with their stress testing. From an uncorrelated perspective, they can go beyond just parallel shifts up and down. They can do what's called a twist. So they can lower the front end of the curve, extend the long end of the curve, and pick the point at which they want that twist to occur and the magnitude and basis points of how that plays out. They're also able to look at spreads and tighten and widen them both by sector and credit rating. That adds a whole new dynamic aspect to the concept of shock analysis. Beyond that, we're seeing our clients run to our multi-asset class risk model. That is for correlated stress tests for factor analysis. They're able to see the impact on both fixed income, equity, alternatives, every sort of private instrument, and see the impact of shocks to the equity markets, shocks to the fixed income markets. Anything that's available in FactSet's economic database is available for our clients to do real-time stress testing. Quickly back to fixed income, we're seeing our clients heavily use our fixed income performance attribution model to see exactly how the performance is being broken down throughout the last year. We're coming to a period of time where attribution, whether it's for internal or external use cases, is something that's mandatory, and it's a huge part of our clients' workflow. They're able to easily identify which components in our model are driving the out or underperformance relative to our market benchmarks we have available on the system. You know, our clients are also able to do things such as look at their duration risk, right, collectively across all assets, not just by running duration off of the spot curve, but also looking at 17 different partial duration points relative to an index. They're paying attention to their top issuer exposure by looking everything by ultimate parent, and then below that, seeing where in the debt capital structure they have exposure to. They're looking at ratings and any potential rating upgrades, downgrades, and changes to their portfolio over a certain horizon. They're able to isolate analysis by just looking at structured products or agency mortgage-backed securities or municipal bonds or just your corporate bonds. We also have tools to assess the liquidity of the bonds in your portfolio. And then ultimately looking at the ability to do some sort of matrix analysis. So the ability to create a spread and duration matrix by sector or by issuer and identify where in that matrix there might be risk and spread.
Matt, that's all great detail. Maybe a slightly different question for you. Do you tend to see the clients, our client base, looking at this as like an all or nothing proposition, or are they picking and choosing from that toolkit? Like, how do you see clients actually choose what to deploy and maybe why?
Great question. I would say most of our clients have a set report set that they use in their toolkit that is part of their monthly, quarterly process to evaluate their risks or to produce client reporting. But the beauty of FactSet is that we are an on-the-fly solution. So in the event that there is a market movement, there is a request internally, or there is a origination of an idea that you want to stress or test your portfolio, we have the data, we have the capacity, and we have the tools to accomplish that. So whether it's something basic from a custom exposure report or something more nuanced with a custom interest rate scenario that you would like to manipulate and see the impact on your portfolios.
That's terrific. Thanks. The spark's an idea for me as possibly one expansion or one extension to our FactSet Insight blog, where maybe a good next step for you and I would be to run a few different scenario examples using the toolkit we've discussed and showcase some of the visuals and some of the reporting around horizon returns, horizon deadlines, things like that. I think that could be really additive to our audience.
Great. Yeah, I agree.
Well, Matt, this has been a great discussion. Thanks so much. To our listeners, thanks for joining. And you can find all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
The FactSet Insight podcast is for informational purposes only. The information contained within is not legal, tax, or investment advice. FactSet does not endorse or recommend any investments and assumes no liability for any consequence relating directly or indirectly to any action or inaction taken based on the information contained in this podcast episode. The views shared by third-party contributors do not necessarily reflect the opinion of FactSet.